What's up, Foos? Main event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me, about to get them, all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This episode sponsored by She's Birdie. Every woman knows that feeling, and She's Birdie knows it too. The just in case feeling. Just in case I hear something. Just in case someone tries the door. Just in case I need to wake up fast. It's not fear, it's awareness. And Birdie Box from She's Birdie was made for exactly that. Birdie Box is a portable travel door alarm designed by She's Birdie for hotels, dorms, Airbnbs, and anywhere you're staying away from home. It installs in seconds on the doorframe, and if the door is opened, it activates a loud siren and flashing strobe to help draw attention instantly. She's Birdie, because peace of mind should check in with you. Birdie Box by She's Birdie. Visit shesbirdie.com. That's shesbirdie.com. And order your Birdie Box before your next stay away from home.
Did you know that the Flooring Depot of Panama City now has kitchen and bathroom cabinets? From a modern shaker design to a traditional raised panel, they've got the perfect cabinets to elevate your home. They even have in-stock selections of those white shaker cabinets, so no waiting around for weeks for products that are back-ordered. And the Flooring Depot offers free design consultations to help make your vision come to life. Stop by the Flooring Depot's main store at the corner of 15th Street and Lisenby, or the Back Beach location, Back Beach Road. Flooring Depot, where we're more than floors.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Here's what you've missed and what's coming up on Conspiracy in Canton.
Officer John O'Keefe was found dead in Canton in January of 2022.
State prosecutors accuse Karen Reed, who was O'Keefe's girlfriend, of backing into him and leaving him to die in the snow.
It seems logical that police would have looked at Karen Reed as a possible suspect. One of her taillights had fresh damage. She openly questioned if she hit John O'Keefe, and prosecutors say she left him a voicemail that night saying she hated him.
While driving to the victim's house, the defendant stated to Ms. McCabe, "Could I have hit him? Did I hit him?"
If the relationship had become toxic by January 2022, as prosecutors allege, it's not apparent from this snapshot in time. At CF McCarthy's in Canton, they laugh and embrace during a night of heavy drinking.
They just seem to be in a happy place, you know.
I will tell you that my client has no criminal intent. She loved this man.
She denies the allegations, arguing instead she's being framed for murder.
An investigation into the death of a Boston police officer in Canton has taken a turn.
Her lawyers argue the police report was altered. Pieces of her taillight weren't found until after her car was taken into custody.
With every new detail comes a new controversy, and nothing is what it seems on the surface.
The defense claims evidence points to other witnesses in the case.
They say there were a lot of people at the home that night, and one of them Googled how long to die in the cold hours before Reed would have known O'Keefe was missing.
I don't think there's any kind of conspiracy or anything like that.
I lived in town for 50 years, and the police have always done a great job.
People in this town are scared of the people who are supposed to protect and serve.
The Commonwealth's theory is supported by nearly nothing. Nothing. Everything that we've suggested is supported by the data, the evidence, and the facts. The Commonwealth's theory is supported by conjecture and really bad policing.
Free Gary Reed! Free Gary Reed! Free Gary Reed! Free Gary Reed! Free Gary Reed!
In the last episode, we began to examine some of the evidence that the defense says not only exonerates their client, but also proves their third-party culpability defense. Now, I know that I mentioned it last week, but before we continue on, I want to remind everyone again that all parties involved, including the defendant and those who are implicated in the defense's theory are all presumed innocent unless proven guilty in a court of law. Last week, we introduced the statements from Lucky, the snowplow driver, who told Trooper Proctor a few really important things. One, that he didn't see a body in the yard at 34 Fairview Road. Two, that he's positive that he would have seen a body if one were there. And three, he witnessed a Ford Edge parked in the street in front of the house, exactly where John's body was found later that morning. Now, this is obviously huge for the defense. None of the witnesses who left the Alberts' home in those early morning hours saw a body lying in the yard when they were pulling out or driving away, though they wouldn't have necessarily had a reason to be looking. Driving a snowplow is a little different, though. I searched for the City of Canton's snow plowing and removal manuals, though the most recent that I was able to obtain is from the 2019 season. I also pulled some from a few surrounding cities to compare, and I spoke to a public works employee from another city who has been plowing and salting roads for almost a decade now. I noticed that the basic training for drivers seems to remain pretty consistent, even in the neighboring areas. Drivers are instructed to watch closely not only what's in front of them, but also what's to their side, especially to the right. This is, in large part, because of mailboxes, trash containers, cars, bikes, and fire hydrants, like the one near where John's body was found. In the interview that Lucky did with Trooper Proctor and Sergeant Buchanick, Lucky says that when he started his route, it was snowing, but not heavily. He's not positive on the time, but he believes that it was around 4 or 4:30 when it was, quote, really snowing, end quote. Lucky also mentions the parking ban that would have been in effect at this time. Now, town bylaws state that all overnight on-street parking from 1 a.m. till 6 a.m. is prohibited between November 15th and April 1st so that the streets are kept clear for snow removal. Violators are subject to a fine for each violation. Lucky says that if the parking doesn't interfere with the removal of snow, it's usually fine. But if it's hindering the snow removal, then they call it in and either police will go and ask them to move the car or the car gets towed. Sergeant Buchanick asks Lucky if he remembers any obstructions from his route that morning, and Lucky tells him about the Ford Edge. He says that it was parked facing Chapman, about 4 or 5 spots away from the driveway. The car wasn't running, and he didn't notice any footprints in the snow around the car before he plowed, but he says that the car was there for a significant amount of time. Sergeant Buchanick asks Lucky, quote, does that mean that you definitely, that there was definitely nobody there, or do you think it might have been obstructed by something if you were driving by, or what? What's your understanding of it, end quote. Lucky responds, quote, I saw no body. My truck is high enough with the lights that I would have seen a body. I can't answer to say if there was something obstructing me. I didn't see anything obstructing me, end quote. So there is a 24-page transcript provided of this interview. Now, this is actually the first interview in more than a year and a half of this investigation that was actually recorded. The information that I've just summarized is what was covered in the beginning, and it takes up about 5.5 pages of this transcript. The next 7 pages consist mostly of the troopers asking Lucky about his conversation with Aiden Carney, aka Turtle Boy. You'll remember that I mentioned Turtle Boy in the first episode as the person who is likely the loudest in the room. He's been reporting on the case on his website and YouTube channels, and he has a substantial social media following as well. He's been very outspoken about his belief in Karen Reed's innocence, and he's organized protests, rallies, and fundraising events for the cause. He's also been very vocal about his belief that the witnesses in this case, the Alberts and McCabes, are actually the ones to blame for the tragic death of John O'Keefe. On his YouTube show, Carney has publicly approached members of the Albert and McCabe family, for example, showing up at Chris Albert's restaurant and approaching Jen McCabe at her child's lacrosse game, where he says he got kicked out for causing a scene because he kept calling her a cop killer. He's also placed calls to people involved in the case, involved in the investigation, and involved in the prosecution, many live on air, including Julian Colin Albert, Trooper Proctor, Proctor's wife, and more. One of the calls that Carney placed for an interview before the lead investigator even spoke to him, was Lucky the snowplow driver. In October of 2023, Carney was arrested and charged with 16 criminal counts connected to the Karen Reed case, including 8 counts of witness intimidation, 3 counts of conspiracy to intimidate a witness, and 5 counts of unlawful picketing to influence a witness. In February, he was also charged with another count of harassing a witness and intercepting wire or oral communications. Carney says that his First Amendment rights are being violated, and the Commonwealth maintains that his type of speech and conduct cannot fairly be considered journalism, and it wouldn't fall under the First Amendment protection. This case is ongoing, and we will dive into this a little bit deeper in the future, but it's important to bring this up now because it relates directly back to Lucky. It's no secret that members of the prosecution and the investigators in this case aren't fans of Turtle Boy. His name and his communications have been brought up in court documents and in pretrial hearings multiple times by ADA Lally, and District Attorney Michael Morrissey even released a video to address the public, demanding the harassment of prosecution witnesses stop.
This will be the first statement of its kind in my dozen years as Norfolk District Attorney. The harassment of witnesses in the murder prosecution of Karen Reed is absolutely baseless. It should be an outrage to any decent person, and it needs to stop. Innuendo is not evidence. False narratives are not evidence.
Marcy goes on to say that the evidence supports the Commonwealth, not the defense, and he addresses the witnesses being targeted.
Some have, without any evidence, pointed to 18-year-old Colin Albert, a nephew of the homeowner, and accused him of attacking John O'Keefe as he entered the home. But phone evidence shows O'Keefe never entered the home at all. Testimony from witnesses tell us that 18-year-old Colin Albert had left his uncle's home before John O'Keefe and Karen Reed had arrived outside the residence. There was no fight inside that home. John O'Keefe did not enter the home. Colin Albert, the young man being vilified, was not present when Reed's vehicle and John O'Keefe arrived on the street. This is a false narrative. Colin Albert didn't commit murder. Jennifer McCabe, Matthew McCabe, and Brian Albert. These people were not part of a conspiracy and certainly did not commit murder or any crime that night. They have been forthcoming with authority, providing statements, and have not engaged in any cover-up. They are not suspects in any crime, they are merely witnesses in the case. To have them accused of murder is outrageous. To have them harassed and intimidated based on false narratives and accusations is wrong. They are witnesses doing what our justice system asks of them. They should not be harassed for telling the government what they heard or saw. I'm asking the Canton community and everyone who feels invested in this case to hear all the actual evidence at trial before assigning guilt to people who have done nothing wrong. And certainly before taking it upon yourself to harass citizens who evidence shows have done nothing in this matter but come forward and bear witness. We try people in the court and not on the internet for a reason. The internet has no rules of evidence. The internet has no punishment for perjury. And the internet does not know all the facts.
So what does this have to do with Lucky? A few things. First of all, the interview that Lucky did with Sergeant Buchanick and Trooper Proctor was done August 10th of 2023. That's a year and 9 months into this investigation. The private investigator for the defense met with Lucky February 15th, just a couple weeks after John's death. The FBI also had already interviewed him and met with him twice, but this far into the investigation, and the lead investigator hadn't even set up an interview with a witness who they know drove by the Albert's yard multiple times that morning. So, what made them finally reach out? Well, let's rewind just a little bit. On June 5th, 2023, Turtle Boy released a story naming Lucky as the driver who plowed Fairview Road that night. He said that he reached out to Lucky via Facebook Messenger, but Lucky responded that he didn't want to answer questions anymore, implying that he had already answered questions to somebody. 2 months later, on August 8th, Turtle Boy posts another story, saying this time that he was able to speak to Lucky, and he gave some information that he says he received. Turtle Boy says at this time that Lucky confirms to him that he has cooperated with the FBI in their investigation. He went by the Alberts' home that night on his route, and he was plowing and did not see a body. He saw a Ford Edge, but said it wasn't Brian Albert's. And he also confirms that, to date, Trooper Proctor had not spoken to him at all. The lead investigator had not spoken to a witness who drove directly by the house that night at all. It's only 2 days after that published story that Lucky comes in to the Norfolk District Attorney's Office for the interview. Also, now, after a year and 9 months, now is the first time that they actually record an interview. There are so many issues and inconsistencies and problems that could have potentially been avoided if they had recorded previous interviews with the witnesses in this case, but they never did. So now they choose to record? It gives the impression that the recording is in order to preserve potential evidence against Turtle Boy, as opposed to getting evidence that could help assist in the investigation into the death of a Boston police officer. They had 21 months to talk to Lucky, but they didn't bother until after he talked to Turtle Boy. I mentioned that the first 5.5 pages of the transcript are asking about January 29th, and the next 7 pages are asking all about Turtle Boy. They ask about the interview that he did with him, the last time he spoke to him, how they talked, and even asked him to open his phone and show them where Turtle Boy called him. When Lucky said that he didn't have it anymore because he regularly cycles his phone and deletes calls every month, they pushed him on this to the point of it sounding uncomfortable or accusatory. The transcripts have a lot of back and forth, so if I read it, then a lot of the information that I'm trying to relay in this situation is going to get lost. So here's a reading of the transcripts, or at least a portion of it. Buchanick.
Do you have your cell phone with you?
Lucky.
Yes, I do.
Can you open it up and show us the time he called and the date?
I don't have him on my phone.
You don't have him on your phone?
No, I do not.
In your call logs, you don't have him calling you? On Monday?
I do not have his number on here.
How come?
I cycle my phone all the time.
You delete your phone numbers?
I delete...
And calls?
Any calls that come in. I keep it for a month, and then I delete.
All right, but Monday was not a month ago.
Correct.
So why do you think that phone number is not on your phone?
I'm sure it's 'cause I deleted it. And I've got 3 days worth of phone calls on my phone right now.
But you said every month you delete it.
It was...
What's the cycle that you delete them at?
So I try to keep my memory, it's not as blocked up. I do go through my texts. I delete my texts. I go through my phones. I delete my phone numbers just to keep my memory.
Okay.
So it doesn't get blocked up.
They continue to question Lucky about whether or not he knew Turtle Boy was going to call him, what time he called, whether or not he recorded him or told him that he was being recorded, what questions he asked him, how he introduced himself, and what Lucky said to him. For a brief moment, they talk about the FBI and private investigators meeting with him, but Buchanan quickly redirects the conversation back to Turtle Boy asking more questions. Eventually, they ask some questions about his route and how long he's been doing that one. They asked again if he saw a body at any point. Lucky again says no. They ask if he saw anyone dragging a body. He says no. They ask about the Ford Edge, and they ask what color it was. Lucky tells them that he doesn't know. He can't really give them that information because he's colorblind. They then ask if it was a light or dark color. Lucky guesses here, and he says, quote, if I were to say it was tan-colored, end quote. Buchanan responds by saying, quote, tan color? Okay, but you are colorblind, end quote. And Lucky confirms, yes, I am. Lucky then reiterates again that he didn't see a body, some of the same details before, and they get ready to conclude the interview. Now, after the transcript shows that they concluded, it seems that they apparently had some type of discussion, and then they go back on the record, and Buchanick says that Lucky remembered something that he wanted to volunteer to support additional discrepancies about what he said to Turtle Boy. So, once again, we go back to the conversation of Turtle Boy, and Lucky clarifies that the trucks that have GPS in them, but he believes that the GPS at the time of the snow was down at the repeater, but not necessarily in the trucks. Buchanick then prompts him about other discrepancies that were apparently just discussed off the record about the direction that he plows the snow. Lucky says that he has to plow to the right, otherwise the snow would just go onto the other side of the road. He says that the private investigators for the defense team stated that he plowed to the left. Now, in the affidavit from the investigator, it doesn't say this, so it's not clear whether this came from an interview or what, but this may be cleared up later at trial. It's worth noting that of the 24-page transcript, 13 of the pages include discussing Turtle Boy or what was said in that interview. When you pair that with the fact that this is the only recorded interview, it seems hard to deny what their motives were here. So what else can we figure out based on the data during this time? We know that witness statements and court documents here are completely unreliable since there are so many mistakes and changing stories. But what else can we analyze? What about those statements that Jen McCabe was awake and pacing? According to Jen's Apple Health and phone data, we know that her phone was locked at 2:31 a.m., just minutes after the controversial Google search. There are 22 steps recorded on her phone in the next few minutes, and then there's no activity reported to Apple Health data for over an hour. At 3:50 a.m., about an hour before Karen calls, Jen McCabe shows movement again, registering about 30 steps before another hour gap in movement. Around 4:30 a.m., Karen wakes up John's niece, frantic and screaming. She tells her to call Mr. Camerano to come pick her up. About 20 minutes later, Jen McCabe receives a call from John's niece saying that Karen needs to talk to her. Jen says Karen gets on the phone yelling that John didn't come home. Based on statements from John's niece and from Jen McCabe, Karen seems confused at this time and doesn't seem to remember what happened the night before, even originally thinking that she'd left John at Waterfall. Jen tells Karen to come there and they will go look for John together. A lot of what happens over the next hour has been scrutinized and picked apart, triggering speculation and rumors from all sides. Julie Albert says in her statement that Jen McCabe called her at 4:55 a.m. She said that she was asleep when Jen called and the call woke her up. The report of her statement says, quote, "That is how she found out about John dying," end quote. The reason that this has fueled the fire is because at this time, nobody would have known yet that John was dead since this is an hour before he was found. In recent court documents, we hear that Julie Albert gave a different version of the story when she testified to a grand jury, stating that she woke up at 5:50 a.m., saw the missed call from Jen, thought even though this call was at 4:55 a.m., she didn't really think anything bad had happened, so she got up, changed clothes, and went to the Albert residence to drop off a gift for her nephew's birthday. In this version of the story, she says that she learned about John's death when she arrived at the Albert home. As a side note, there are a lot of wrong times and wrong information and varying stories given in statements, so I'm not going to bog down this timeline with all of it, just what's relevant right now. We went over all of the conflicting stories in episode 2 if you want to go back and check that out. According to the PCA, Karen calls one of John's friends, Carrie Roberts, around 5 a.m., worried about John, and then she calls Jen back. Jen tells Karen to come to her house, they'll go find John together. So at 5:07 a.m., ring footage at John's house captures video of Karen backing out of John's garage, striking his car that's parked in the driveway behind her. Now, this video is incredibly important for a few reasons. One, because the defense says that that's how she cracked her taillight. And two, because although the video isn't the clearest, you can see her taillight as she's driving away. So first, let's talk about her striking John's car. I'll be honest, when I first saw the video, it didn't look to me like she hit his car. I didn't see the impact until the video was slowed down and zoomed in, at which point I was only able to see it when looking at the tire or the back window on his car as it shifts forward slightly with the impact. It's also important to note that the police said they went to John's house and there was no damage to his car and no pieces of taillight in his driveway. You also don't see taillight on the snow by his car when she drives away after striking it, though you can see a crack in her taillight when she moves forward. Now, this is going to be totally up to the jury to decide what they see. I'll put a link to the video up on the timeline that I created on 13thjurorpodcast.com, and you can decide for yourself what you think. With the snow falling, it's hard to get a very clear picture, and depending on where you pause the video, it may look different. So watch the entire time and get different perspectives. Come to your own conclusions. It is clear from the video, however, that her taillight is still intact. It's not busted out or missing or shattered. But what do you see? Is it enough for reasonable doubt? Think about this. What if the investigation and the reports hadn't been so messy? What if everything had been done properly and by the book, and there weren't so many errors and conflicting stories? Would you see it differently then? We talk a lot when following trials about the totality of evidence and how one piece alone wouldn't be enough to convict someone. But when you put everything together, it paints a clearer picture. This is one of the cases where I can't help but wonder if it's the opposite. The community's lack of trust in the investigators is a direct result of their actions. Would we even think twice about some of the evidence if we were able to have full assurance in how things were handled? Are we automatically more critical of every piece of evidence that we see or hear simply because we lost faith in those in charge? The taillight evidence is one of the most critical pieces to this case, and I think these are all important questions to ask ourselves as we move forward. We'll be right back.
Did you know that the Flooring Depot of Panama City now has kitchen and bathroom cabinets? From a modern shaker design to a traditional raised panel, they've got the perfect cabinets to elevate your home. They even have in-stock selections of those white shaker cabinets, so no waiting around for weeks for products that are back-ordered. And the Flooring Depot offers free design consultations to help make your vision come to life. Stop by the Flooring Depot's main store at the corner of 15th Street and Lisenby, or the Back Beach location, Back Beach Road. Flooring Depot, where we're more than floors.
So let's take a look at Karen's movements when she left John's house. We know based on video footage collected that she first drove toward Waterfall, passing cameras at 5:11 a.m., and then she turned back the other direction away from Waterfall, heading north toward where the Alberts and Jen McCabe live at 5:15 a.m. Now, if you remember in the last episode, I mentioned there are three routes that Karen could have taken, two of which pass by Canton Library. This direction that she's driving is one of those routes. She's seen on camera again at 5:18 a.m. toward the intersection of Washington and Dedham Streets. But we don't have any more information from this point forward about where she can be seen. According to phone data, we know that Karen and Jen were on the phone for a lot of the driving up to this point. So here's where things get questionable, and we probably won't have answers until we get to trial. The camera where Karen was spotted at 5:18 is about a 4 to 6 minute drive from Jen McCabe's house if she goes straight there from this intersection. But there are two other routes that could take anywhere from 8 to 10 minutes. So if she went directly there, we could estimate that she would have arrived around 5:22 to 5:24 a.m. or somewhere in that range. We know that Karen and Jen were on the phone until 5:20, and then Jen called John. She talked to Karen again at 5:26 and again at 5:32, this time for just over a minute, before they hung up and Jen calls Tom Betty. So 5:33 a.m. is the last that Jen and Karen were on the phone. So normally we would assume that that meant that she hadn't arrived there yet. We know that Jen's location shows that she left her house with Karen at 5:39, So we could assume that Karen arrived sometime in that 6-minute window between 5:33 and 5:39. That leaves about 10 to 15 minutes where we aren't sure where Karen was, although we do know that she was on the phone with Jen for parts of this. She and Jen weren't close, so it's very possible that she didn't know where she was going. Remember, she had just gotten lost in this neighborhood the night before. And in her hysteria, she took one of the longer routes or got turned around. It's also possible that she was still driving around looking for John. Remember, she had just driven to Waterfall looking for him and then turned around and headed north. So it doesn't make much sense that she would know where he was, because if she did, she wouldn't have gone there first. So is it possible that she drove by Fairview Road at this time? Let's just assume that she did and see how the evidence lines up to this. If Karen drove by Fairview and there was snow and it was hard to see John's body, she could have driven right past and not seen him. It's definitely possible, and it could account for the extra few minutes, especially considering we've already heard that she was hysterical and possibly still intoxicated. And what if she did see him? When Karen got to Jen's, they left together to head to John's house, and Carrie followed behind them in the car. Jen drove because she said that Karen was, again, way too hysterical to drive, and Carrie is the one who said that she believed that Karen was actually still intoxicated. So, on the way to John's, Jen said that Karen was emotional, and she was asking, could I have hit him? Did I hit him? The statements also say that when they arrived at John's house, that's when Karen told them about her cracked taillight. Jen said they looked for John inside the house to make sure that he wasn't there, and then they drove to look for him. Carrie drove her car, Jen McCabe rode in the passenger seat, and Karen sat in the back. The first place they went was to 34 Fairview. Jen and Carrie both said that the snow at this time was creating poor visibility, and they said that when they approached the house, neither of them saw John, but Karen did, and she yelled for Carrie to pull the car over. Carrie said that she stopped in the middle of the road, and Karen jumped out and ran over to John, throwing herself on top of him to warm him up. According to the PCA, Jen and Carrie said that they were initially confused when Karen said that she saw John, since neither of them saw him right away. So could Karen have driven by and seen him before she made it to Jen McCabe's? We know that there was snow on John at this point, so is it possible that she saw something, but in her hysterical state, she didn't really want to stop or didn't believe that it could really have been him? What would each side make of this? The prosecution could say that she knew where he was when she arrived with Carrie and Jen because she had driven by there already. The defense can point out that she obviously didn't know that he was there before that, or she wouldn't have driven to Waterfall to look for him first. Also, if she had seen him before, there would be no reason for her not to stop. It didn't really change anything having Jen and Carrie with her when
she found him. It's human nature to speculate when we are trying to make sense of things. But let's look at this as logically as possible. What could any of this information potentially prove? Does it support any of the current theories? Let's take a look at that. One theory is that Karen ran over John in a fit of rage, intentionally killing him and leaving him to die, then blaming the others who were there. If Karen had murdered John and left, why would she have gone to his house to sleep? Why would she have called him minutes after she left, leaving him a voicemail? It doesn't make sense to leave an angry, drunk voicemail yelling at someone when you know that you just killed them. It also wouldn't make sense to call the homeowner's sister to help you if you're about to frame her and her family for a murder that you just committed at her sister's house. It doesn't make sense that she would drive to Waterfall looking for John if she knows that he was in Brian and Nicole Albert's yard. And I've even heard that people think that she hit John's car backing out of the driveway intentionally so that she could use that as a defense to cover her tracks. That obviously doesn't seem to make much sense, because if she were covering her tracks, she would have hit his car a lot harder. Hard enough to cause damage to his car to explain the damage to hers. Not just a brief impact that you have to watch closely to even see. It seems like all evidence points to Karen not knowing that John was dead or dying when she was on the way to his house after dropping him off, and to her not knowing where he was when she woke up. This evidence may not tell us what did happen, but I think it helps us see what didn't happen. And that's at least a start. So if Karen didn't know where John was or that he was dead, that means either something else happened to him after she left, or if she did hit and kill him, she didn't know or remember. Hearing the details of finding John in the snow are heartbreaking. At 6:03, Jen McCabe calls 911. The call lasts for about 3.5 minutes. Canton Police Department responded to the call of unresponsive John O'Keefe, and Officer Saraf was the first on scene. Canton Fire and EMS were dispatched, and CPR was in progress. According to the PCA, Katie McLaughlin said that she arrived and John was being worked on by paramedics. Once inside the ambulance, she observed him to have trauma to his face and eye area and vomit in his mouth. Katie McLaughlin said that she asked Karen if she knew where the victim suffered trauma, and according to the PCA, Karen said, quote, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him," end quote. None of the other statements from first responders or first on the scene reported hearing this, though we do have statements from Sergeant Good, Patrolman Saraf, Sergeant Lank, and Mulaney. All of their statements were pretty consistent, though, about how hysterical Karen was and hearing her screaming multiple times, "Is he dead?" Jen's call with 911 ends, and seconds later, she calls her sister Nicole. This would obviously make sense, since they are in Nicole and Brian Albert's yard. One thing that I've never been able to wrap my mind around is why Brian and Nicole Albert would not have come outside if there's a dead officer in their yard. Nicole said in her statement that she had only met John once or twice, and Brian said the same thing. He'd only met John a few times, and neither of them knew Karen. But I've never understood why they didn't come out during this time. The explanation has been that they were asleep, but at 6:07 and 6:08, Jen calls her sister, and both calls show up as answered on the call sheet, one for 9 seconds and the other for 7 seconds. In documents filed by the prosecution, ADA Lally says that calls that go to voicemail register as answered. If these calls were, in fact, voicemails instead of answered calls, there are ways to show that, so I'm sure that we will hear about this again during the trial. One thing that has been at the center of some of the controversy surrounding this case is the Apple Health data that was provided. I want to talk about that for a moment. John O'Keefe's last movement, according to GPS data points, was at 12:25, and his last steps before he was found the next morning were recorded at 12:32. Fast forward to the next morning when John is found unresponsive outside at Fairview Road. His phone begins recording steps again. Now, this isn't unexpected. In any normal case, we may see steps recorded. There's documentation with a chain of custody of when and where the phone is collected and by who. And the step and location data is assumed to be associated with whoever is in possession of the phone at that time. But one thing that we know for sure is that this case isn't like any other normal case. In what is probably one of the strangest and most nonsensical arguments that I can remember hearing from a prosecutor, ADA Lally argues in a hearing in May of last year that Apple Health data is unreliable, and his example as to why are the steps recorded on John's phone after his death.
As it pertains to the Apple Health data, and obviously we'll get into this a little bit more when it comes to that subsequent Rule 17 motion, the Apple Health data is the same Apple Health data that's being relied upon for the supposition that Mr. O'Keefe went inside the house. That same Apple Health data has, among other things, Mr. O'Keefe taking 46 steps and traveling a certain bit of distance around 11:56 a.m. on January 29th. The problem with that is that he was pronounced deceased at the Good Samaritan Medical Center at 7:50 a.m., some 4 hours prior to that.
Obviously, this makes no sense. So let's take a look at John's health data and compare it to what we know about who had his phone. I bet you won't be surprised to find out that this is yet another hot topic in this case. You may remember in a previous episode, I mentioned a report that claimed Jen McCabe said John's phone was underneath his body. I thought that was just such a strange thing to have in the documents, since there are so many things that should have been in the documents about his phone that weren't, and so many things that were incorrect and things that were unclear and things that were changed. I wondered why that comment was included, but the information about custody of his phone was left out. I also wondered how she knew that his phone was underneath him, since they didn't give us any more information than that. But at least they gave us that. So we know that his phone was underneath him. That means that the steps and location changes that happen on his phone can only be explained by someone else taking possession of it. Who that is, we don't know yet. Trooper Guarino's report says, quote, "On Saturday, January 29th, 2022, Trooper Michael Proctor and Sergeant Yuri Bukinik of the Norfolk District Attorney's Office responded to an unattended death of John O'Keefe at 34 Fairview Road in Canton. Through his investigation, it was found that O'Keefe was a victim of a motor vehicle homicide. While on scene, Trooper Proctor secured O'Keefe's cell phone and brought it to the Norfolk DA's office for forensic analysis," end quote. However, we later hear that Proctor wasn't actually there that morning or that day, so it's unclear how he actually got the phone. The first steps on John's phone began recording somewhere in the time frame between 6:04 and 6:11. And according to Trooper Guarino's report, the first change of location registered at 6:15. This means that someone picked up John's phone at 6:15 a.m. Now that narrows things down a lot because there weren't that many people there yet at 6:15. Obviously, we know Karen, Carrie Roberts, and Jen McCabe were there. Officer Seraph was the first on the scene, followed by Canton Fire and Rescue, who arrived about the same time as Officer Mullaney, and then Sergeant Good. Lank's report said that he didn't arrive until 6:24, and if that's accurate, then it couldn't have been him who originally grabbed the phone. Steps on John's phone continue with periodic gaps. This 6:15 timestamp that Guarino mentions shows GPS movement, marks the beginning of more than 2 hours of a pattern of moving around almost as if the phone is in someone's pocket at the scene. At 8:24, the last steps are recorded before a 2-hour and 40-minute stretch with none, the longest break since the phone started recording movement. They pick up again at 11:06, and no more steps are recorded after 11:56. Sergeant Lank is said to have left Fairview Road at 7:24 to return to Canton Police Department, though he did return after 9 when Jen McCabe called him and asked him to come back. There was another hour of this off-and-on movement on the phone when Lank returned to Canton PD, so it doesn't seem likely that he would have taken the phone at that time, since it probably wouldn't still be moving at that point. It's possible that one of the other officers had it, and for some reason it's just not detailed in the reports properly. The gap in the steps that are recorded are interesting when compared to the full timeline. Julie Albert showed up at 34 Fairview around 8:30 a.m. to drop off a gift for Brian Jr.'s birthday. Now, from the outside, 8:30 a.m. seems like an odd time to decide to take a birthday present to someone who you know was up partying until after 2 a.m. But not everyone does things the same, so this could be normal for them. Regardless, the timeline reveals that the steps on the phone stopped recording around the time that Julie Albert arrived. About half an hour later is when Jen McCabe calls Sergeant Lank and asks him to come back because she's remembered some things that she forgot to tell him. For example, she remembered that Karen said something to the effect of, "I hope I didn't hit him." A little time passes, and at 10:55, Jen McCabe receives a call from Trooper Proctor. Within minutes, John's phone briefly starts recording steps again, and then Jen McCabe leaves 34 Fairview Road. John's phone records steps again within minutes of the time Jen McCabe arrives home around 11:20, and shortly after that, Sergeant Bukinik and Trooper Proctor also arrived at Jen's house to interview her. The last steps on the report are shown at 11:56, while Trooper Proctor and Sergeant Bukinik are still at the McCabe's. Now, there's been speculation that Jen McCabe possibly had John's phone, but we have to remember, the location data should show where it was, so this is something that will be cleared up during trial. And if the location data showed that it was at Jen McCabe's house or with Jen McCabe, that would support the defense's theory, so I'm sure that we would have already heard it by now. We've made it through our data timeline, and now it's time to start going through the rest of the investigation. Our next episode is going to focus on analyzing the evidence, like DNA, the argument over a hair that may or may not be a human hair, depending on who you ask, the German Shepherd Chloe and how Chloe made her way into ongoing court battles, blood collected in solo cups, John's clothing, and the injuries he sustained. Evidence usually has to be pretty strong against a defendant in order to take a murder case to trial. Karen was initially charged with manslaughter, which is punishable by up to 20 years in prison. That could be voluntary manslaughter, which would mean killing in what's commonly known as the heat of passion, or involuntary manslaughter, which is the killing of another person caused by reckless conduct or during the commission of battery. But the charges were upgraded to second-degree murder. According to Massachusetts general laws, first-degree murder is committed with deliberately premeditated malice aforethought, or with extreme atrocity or cruelty, or in the commission or attempted commission of a crime punishable with death or imprisonment for life. And second-degree murder is any murder that is not first-degree murder. First-degree includes premeditation. In this case, that's been ruled out. So for a second-degree conviction, the jury would need to believe, first of all, that Karen killed John, and second, that she either intended to kill him, or she intended to cause him grievous bodily harm, or that she should have known her act would lead to a strong likelihood of death. The sentence for this is life in prison with the possibility of parole no sooner than after serving 15 years in prison. The jury will usually have the option to convict for one of the lesser charges based on what they believe the evidence points to, and of course, they'll also have the option to acquit her if there's reasonable doubt that she's responsible for John's death. Is the conspiracy all about framing Karen? Or is the conspiracy all about pushing a narrative and spreading information in an attempt to get the case dismissed? How does the evidence stack up against her and those charges? We'll take a look next week on Conspiracy in Canton. My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane. Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.